Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in the cause of Aluminum Company of America versus Alm.
Mr. Randy, can I please the court? Mr. Randy, you are to present argument for petition. Can I please the court? I'm Randy Roche, counsel petitioner of Aluminum Company of America. I am joined at the counsel table by my partner, my colleague, who is Alcoa trial counsel below. We are essentially advancing three arguments this morning. The first is that the Court of Appeals erred in failing to consider the 7-Up National Soft Drink Company as an appropriate intermediary under this court's new intermediary rule, first announced in this court's previous decision in this case. The second is that the Court of Appeals erred in failing to remand the ordinary negligence and compensatory damages issues for a new trial. And the third argument is that the Court of Appeals did not err in remanding the gross negligence and punitive damages issue for a new trial. Our first point is that the Court of Appeals erred in its consideration or its refusal to consider the 7-Up company to be an appropriate intermediary under this court's new rule. As this court is well aware, in July of 1986, this court's opinion said, for the very first time in Texas, we will apply an intermediary doctrine outside the prescription drug context. Because of Alcoa's unique position in this case, with respect both to the cap and the capping machine, this court felt it appropriate to say Alcoa has a duty to warn the ultimate consumer if it has knowledge of this hazard. But it may discharge that duty by adequately warning the appropriate intermediary. The problem comes with the court's mandate. The Court of Appeals wrote in its opinion, at least the majority of the Court of Appeals, that it interpreted this court's mandate as limiting its review of the intermediary rule on ordinary negligence to one intermediary, JFW. We believe, and Justice Sears wrote in his dissent to that opinion, that was an incorrect interpretation of this court's mandate. The only sensible interpretation of this court's rule and this court's mandate, as he wrote, is to consider the national soft drink company, 7-Up, as an appropriate intermediary through whom Alcoa can attempt to discharge its duty to warn the ultimate consumer. Now, the reason for that should be obvious. Every party in this case, both Alm and Alcoa, admits, argues, concedes that 7-Up has exclusive control over the package. If there was going to be a warning put on this package of soft drink, the party who would have to do it would be the national soft drink company, 7-Up. So in the constellation of what makes an appropriate intermediary under this court's rule, a party who is adequately trained and warned, familiar with the propensities of the product, and capable of passing along the warning to the ultimate consumer, it is inconceivable that 7-Up would not be such an appropriate intermediary. Nevertheless, the court wrote that it was restricted from considering the 7-Up evidence on the ordinary negligence issue. I hasten to note that the court went on to consider the 7-Up evidence on the gross negligence issue and found that that evidence was sufficient to negate the gross negligence finding. I'll address that in a second. We believe that Justice Sears' position should be adopted, that there is no reason and no precedent for limiting the scope of this court's intermediary rule to any particular intermediary, and certainly the party best able to pass on the warning to the ultimate consumer must be considered an appropriate intermediary under this court's rule. The remedy, we believe, is obvious. Either remand that with that issue, whether 7-Up is an appropriate intermediary, back to the court, back to the trial court, along with the gross negligence issue, or send that issue back to the Court of Appeals on remand. But the problem, I hasten to know, with sending that issue back to the Court of Appeals, say Court of Appeals, look at 7-Up now, just like you looked at JFW, is that this record concerning 7-Up was necessarily limited by the fact that this case was not tried in contemplation of this court's intermediary rule. That dovetails into my second point, Your Honor, which is that the trial court erred in failing to remand this case on ordinary negligence issues. The reasons are threefold. One, because the case was not tried in any respect under or in contemplation of this court's intermediary rule. The second is that the jury was not instructed by the trial court on the court's new intermediary rule. And the third is that it affirming an ordinary negligence finding would, we believe, constitute a due process violation. It should be plain from the law that this court and no Texas court had ever said that an intermediary rule or doctrine should apply in a case such as this. 2 months, 1 month before this court's opinion, the Court of Appeals in Dallas, Judge Story, wrote that he had looked at all Texas cases concerning intermediary doctor and found that it had never been extended outside of prescription drug cases. And for that reason, in Kahn versus Velsipol, a chemical bulk supplier case, the court found that it could not analyze whether or not the intermediary had been warned in order to discharge the remote manufacturer's duty to warn. This court, in its opinion, I think, makes abundantly clear that this was a case of first impression and that it was, in effect, adopting the intermediary rule for a case such as this outside of the prescription drug context. So it should not be surprising that the trial court did not try this case in contemplation of the rule. And in fact, the jury was precluded from receiving evidence on precisely this issue. When Alcoa tendered its evidence that it had warned 7-Up, and that evidence is before this court, all objected and said that evidence was irrelevant to any issue in this case. Unfortunately, the trial court sustained that objection, and the only reason this 7-Up evidence is before this court is because Alcoa made a limited offer of that evidence on the gross negligence issue. But the effect is that the jury was told that the 7-Up evidence is not relevant to your consideration of whether Alcoa is negligent with respect to its warning obligation. We believe that Justice Sears' opinion, in a sense, speaks appropriately, that the trial court having denied the jury the opportunity to consider whether Alcoa had discharged its duty to warn under the new intermediary rule, that issue ought to be remanded back for a new trial so that both the jury can have the evidence and so that the jury could be instructed on this court's new intermediary rule. You can be certain that Alcoa would have defended this case much differently if it had anticipated that it could discharge its duty to warn through intermediary warning. There are other intermediaries beyond JFW and 7-Up through whom Alcoa believes that it could discharge its duty to warn. For example, a retailer. In any bulk supplier case, if the retailer who sells it immediately to the ultimate consumer is knowledgeable about the hazard, is trained and warned enough to pass along the warning, being the retailer, it can pass along that warning, Alcoa or any other party in Alcoa's position should be able to discharge its duty through that retailer. So if this case had been tried under the new intermediary rule, then the court should instruct that the jury not limit its review only to JFW or to 7-Up, but should also include any other intermediary that Alcoa offers as an intermediary through whom it discharges its duty to warn. This precise issue of whether or not a jury should be instructed on the court's intermediary rule was considered by the Fifth Circuit in two software cases. Those are Leonard versus Alcoa and Casilla versus Alcoa. Both cases, the Fifth Circuit found that because the jury had not been instructed on the court's new all rule, that a new trial was required so that the jury could be instructed that Alcoa could discharge its duty to warn through an intermediary. We believe there's no difference between this case and Leonard or Casilla, and this case too should be remanded for a new trial. The third reason that the ordinary negligence issue should be remanded for a new trial is because there is a due process violation in affirming in this situation. When the jury is not instructed and the jury is not given any evidence on the ordinary negligence issue concerning the Alcoa's ability to discharge its duty, affirming an ordinary negligence finding, which was not made by that jury below, would be like entering judgment without the necessity of a trial on that issue. We believe that the fundamental requirements of due process is that a defendant have notice of the charges against it, have the opportunity to present its defenses against those charges. Alcoa did not know that it was being found liable on appeal by the Court of Appeals for failing to discharge its duty through an intermediary. If we'd known, obviously, we would have done something different at the trial court level. That's why the Court of Appeals erred in affirming the ordinary negligence issue, but Alcoa neither had the evidence opportunity to get evidence in on that issue or have the jury properly instructed that it could discharge its duty to warn through an intermediary. The third issue we wish to raise with this court concerns the gross negligence issue. And admittedly, it's mostly defensive with respect to the argument that Alm is raising before this court. Alm contends that the Court of Appeals erred in remanding the gross negligence and punitive damages issues, and there are numerous arguments that Alm is advancing in support of that proposition, and I'd like to deal with some of those now. The first is that all contend that the Court of Appeals used the wrong standard for reviewing factual sufficiency on the gross negligence issue. We believe that that position is without merit. The Court of Appeals opinions specifically cites to Herbert v. Herbert and to the Poole decision and acknowledges that we must consider all the evidence in support of and contrary to the finding, and we must uphold that finding unless the evidence is so weak or the finding so great against so greatly against the preponderance of evidence as to be manifestly unjust or erroneous. And that certainly is the case for this court. The Alcoa evidence of 10 pages of documents, in essence, referring to Alcoa's slideshow presentation and its efforts to make 7-Up and the 7-Up bottlers aware of this hazard in order to allow them to try to prevent that hazard from occurring by improving their application of caps does more than suffices to negate the conscious indifference standard, which is the proper definition of gross negligence. But it cannot be said that the Court of Appeals used the wrong standard on factual sufficiency because it's the precise issue, the precise definition and standard that this Court had long adopted. As I mentioned, we believe that that evidence is more than sufficient to negate the conscious indifference finding, and that evidence is before this Court, and it's in the appendices to Alm's application for writ of error. Alm also contends that a new definition of gross negligence should be adopted by this Court. They are proposing what they style as a definition that requires evidence of some significance to meet the problem. We believe that that is not a necessary extension for this Court to make, and it's an unprecedented extension, and simply is not warranted by the cases that they cite. In essence, what I think wants this Court to do is to prohibit further factual sufficiency reviews of an affirmative gross negligence finding, and that simply isn't warranted in this context. The conscious indifference standard, and as articulated in the William v. Steves case and the other cases of this Court, is more than adequate to make sure that the jury is properly instructed in the proper definition of gross negligence. The two cases that Alm presents in this Court, Atlas Chemical versus Anderson and Nave versus National Supply, do not argue for or advocate a new definition of gross negligence. That definition is the same one that was used here. Moreover, that case should be distinguished from the instant case because in those cases, the underlying liability finding was of an intentional tort. And those situations, the situation factually was much more egregious than what is presented to this Court in this appeal. In that case, virtually identical factual situations, a polluter knew that it was harming the land of the plant, had been polluting and harming the land for some time, had been the subject of essentially governmental cease and desist orders to stop polluting, but the Court found, nevertheless, had made no effort of any real significance to stop the polluting and continued to pollute for several years. That kind of ongoing action in direct contravention of an order to stop is completely different from this situation, because Alcoa did make an effort to make sure that the national soft drink companies, such as 7-Up, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Dash Root Beer, and others, were aware of the potential problem if a cap was not applied properly by a bottler. They were apprised through the 35-millimeter slide presentation of the serious personal consequences. Again, the Court of Appeals wrote, the cartoon in the slide presentation shows a bottle cap coming off the bottle and breaking through a glass window, that kind of horrific force. The evidence showed that 7-Up appreciated what it was being told, appreciated Alcoa's efforts along those lines, and that Alcoa wanted to continue to make those presentations to other 7-Up bottlers. So Alcoa tried to do something about this problem. But it was Alcoa's position below and Alcoa's position today that what it did was all that it could do under the circumstances, because it is the remote manufacturer of a cap machine, not the product that caused Mr. Alm his injury, and because it is at best a remote designer of the cap that injured Mr. Alm. Alcoa is not in a position to warn the ultimate consumer, either to identify the ultimate consumer or communicate with him. And the factual matter must be remembered that this was not Alcoa's cap. This cap was manufactured by Hutchinson. Alcoa never physically possessed this cap. It did supply the capping machine, which made the cap. But neither the capping machine nor the cap, as designed, is defective. There's no finding, no suggestion that either the cap design that Hutchinson copied in part from Alcoa or the capping machine that made this cap is defective. It's not until the bottler negligently uses that capping machine in when it fails to properly apply the cap skill to properly adjust and maintain that machine that any hazard ever exists. And if the evidence below was, if the bottler correctly applies this cap, there is no hazard. So Alcoa's position is, we want the bottlers and the franchises that control those bottlers to appreciate the harm that could be done by the misapplied cap to make sure that caps are not misapplied. And then if they don't believe that they can successfully prevent bad caps from reaching the consumer, then the bottler and franchisor has the option of warning. But since they control the package, they control the warning, the ability to warn the ultimate consumer, that's their choice. Probably the most important issue that this court can address in connection with gross negligence deals with the reasonable assurance concept, which Alan is going to speak to you about briefly. This court's decision says that it's important that the party trying to discharge its duty to warn have reasonable assurance that warnings will reach the ultimate consumer. Now, we believe that language needs to be slightly modified because if the test should not be, as Alm will suggest to you, that the consumer must actually receive the information or even be likely to receive that information. All of the bulk supplier cases, all of the prescription drug cases, and the comments to Section 388 of the restatement all make clear that that is not required. An intermediary discharges his duty to warn when he apprises with accurate information, warnings and instructional information, an appropriate intermediary when that link is completed. Even if the information does not reach the ultimate consumer, the liability is discharged. Now that is the literal language of Section 388, comment L. It is also the explicit finding of Jones v. Hiddle, which is the case this court cited in its 1986 opinion in this case. And it is the obvious result in any prescription drug case as well. If the plaintiff or patient does not receive the information, if nevertheless the remote supplier has given appropriate information to an appropriate intermediary, its liability is discharged and it will not be found liable for the information not reaching the ultimate consumer. Now, that's a very important distinction that the courts, and certainly the court in Idaho, in the Slyman versus Alcoa case, did not appreciate it. There are other courts of appeals decisions which similarly are in a position to misinterpret this court's intermediary rule. So we believe that this court should clarify in its opinion, in this appeal, that what reasonable assurance means and what reasonable assurance does not mean. We believe that the Court of Appeals framed it as accurately as can be without going into the comment L, the 388 analysis, the Jones v. Hiddle analysis, which I just presented to the court. It boiled it down very simply to accurate warnings and instructional information being given to an appropriate intermediary. That's what reasonable assurance ought to mean. It should not mean that if the ultimate consumer does not get the information or is not likely to get the information, that it did not discharge its liability. That just is not the test. As a matter of fact, I think the language in Jones v. Hiddle is that when the vendee gives the information to the appropriate intermediary, if that information is not passed on by the intermediary, that intervening failure breaks the chain of causation. Now, that's the kind of analysis that all the other bulk supplier cases in this country prior to this court's decision that did not cite this court's previous opinion, that's the way they analyze it, and that's the proper analysis. Your Honor, the last argument that will be advanced by all is that his right to trial by jury is violated if the gross negligence issue is remanded back for new trial. That's a concept that I do not understand. It seems to me the perfect remedy if you believe your right to trial by jury is being violated is to get a new trial on that issue. What we believe is appropriate, as we believed all along, is for the jury to retry this case with both instructions and evidence on Alcoa's efforts to warn intermediaries, and with the jury being told that Alcoa can discharge its duty to warn through an intermediary, we believe that justice can be done. At the present time, however, that record is not before this court. The jury was not apprised of that information. It was precluded from that information by the trial court sustaining the relevance objection to it. The jury obviously was not instructed that Alcoa could discharge its duty to warn. And both of those things need to be clarified in this court's opinion so that when this case is remanded, that the jury, the trial court judge, will have full appreciation of Alcoa's ability to discharge its duty to warn and that the jury should be instructed on that. We also believe that whether this court sends the case back to the Court of Appeals or to the jury, it is important to clarify for precedential purposes that this court did not intentionally limit the appropriate intermediaries to one, the bottler. National soft drink companies like 7-Up must be appropriate intermediaries. Retailers like Lewis & Coker must be appropriate intermediaries if the remote supplier in Alcoa's shoes can show that it sent appropriate information or that party was already aware of the hazard and was capable of passing along the warning.
Under Section 388, you say the only duty then is to apply to supply appropriate information to the intermediary.
That's right.
It doesn't have to be done in a way to emphasize that information.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It can be the fine print in a multi-volume set of catalogs or instructional bulletins.
No, Your Honor. That's the point where I disagree. If the intermediary does not understand that what the hazard is not adequately trained and instructed, does not appreciate that, then that wouldn't satisfy the intermediary factor. So if there was fine print and it was hidden and was not appreciated, it would not discharge the remote supplier's duty to warn. But even if it was in fine print, if that intermediary already knew about the hazard, already knew what was necessary to prevent that hazard from occurring, and then could decide whether or not to warn, if it decides not to warn and an accident occurs, then the remote manufacturer's liability would nevertheless have been discharged.
Does he have a duty to bring that information to the attention of the intermediary in a way and with an emphasis that will likely see that it is conveyed to the ultimate consumer?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it is likely, that the question of whether the information is likely to get to the ultimate consumer is a test. We believe that once the information gets to the intermediary has the ability to act one way or the other, to make an informed judgment as to whether he will warn or not. But that's enough. So that in your situation, if the intermediary says, I decided not to warn, you know, bottle cap case says, I believe all of my bottlers understand the problem and will do the quality control procedures necessary to prevent that problem from ever reaching the retail shelf. And therefore, we are not going to warn that if there's a bottle cap explosion, that there should be no liability. And that's the situation we face here today.
Is Alcoa or a manufacturer in a similar situation in a superior position to understand the full extent and nature of the danger than the intermediary?
No, if there was a full trial in this case, we believe the evidence would show that the national software and companies are just as surprised as Alcoa, if not more surprised. It's their products that are being exploded, and they hear about it first. We hear about bottle cap cases from the national software and companies. They obviously have a PR problem as well as a liability problem. They're aware of the situation, and it doesn't take that much to correct this problem. And all the bottlers have to do is make sure those headsets are properly adjusted, and then follow a good quality control procedure to look at the cap after they're applied to see whether or not there's a problem. Many, many, many hundreds, whatever the number is, of bottlers never have a blow-up instance. Their quality control procedures are fine. No warning would be necessary for them. Alcoa doesn't know whether or not a bottler is going to follow those procedures and not have a problem, and so the failure to warn is appropriate, or whether the bottler is not going to pursue those. The franchisor, like 7-Up, the national soft drink company, is in a position. You know, they can yank that franchise if they're concerned about the safety of their product being bothered by that company. So they are in the best position, both to understand whether or not there's a problem, to decide whether or not their warning is necessary on their behalf. If that's all the questions, Your Honor, I'll give the court back to the time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Senator Matthews and Mr. Timothy Lee will present argument for respondents. Mr. Timothy Lee will open. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Tim Lee with Doug Matthews, and we represent the plaintiff. We're here both petitioner and respondent. I'm going to take about 10 minutes. I'm going to respond to some of Alcoa's positions that you have just heard. I'm also going to affirmatively present one of our own points of error. Doug will take the remaining period of time, and he will be talking about the two other points of error the petition advances. Before dealing with the specific kinds of arguments that Mr. Roach presents, I think it's useful to talk about what this case is really about. This case is about a supplier and manufacturer, Alcoa, who was faced with a problem of consumer injury coming about from bottle cap blow-off. The evidence of this trial showed that there had been 127 other claims and lawsuits similar to plaintiff's claim of an eye injury resulting because of this process. The evidence at trial showed that the problem had existed for 7 years prior to plaintiff's injury. The evidence at trial showed that the number of consumer injuries coming about because of alcohol exposure blowing off were increasing both in the raw number and in the frequency in which the injury is occurring. It should have been clear to Alcoa that whatever they were doing to try to alleviate the problem, it was not working. It obviously was clear to the jury that whatever Alcoa was doing to alleviate the problem was not working. Mr. Roach suggests in a number of different places that Alcoa would have tried this case entirely differently if they had the advantage of this court's opinion the first time we were up here on the Allen case. That's an interesting suggestion, because if the court looks at the evidence that we cite in our application for writ of error, the court will note that Alcoa's corporate representative, George Overture, and their primary expert witness, Jay Gibbs, both testified that they didn't feel warnings to consumers were necessary. Alcoa felt that warnings should not be given. Alcoa defended this case on the basis that warnings shouldn't be given. That was the testimony. If the case were to be retried, that would have to be the testimony again. The position they took is the position they now will have to live with. In this court's prior opinion on the case, the court established the general rule that Alcoa has a duty to act in a reasonable fashion to warn the ultimate consumer of the hazard. And that's just a very ordinary kind of extension of negligence principles to a specific fact pattern. It is not, as Alcoa would have you believe, some sort of great and unprecedented change dropped on them from out of the blue. The only thing that is different about this case, as opposed to any number of other intermediary cases, are the specific facts. And if Alcoa had consulted the 1934 version of the restatement, they would have found the same rule in the comments to Section 388 as this court used in its first decision on the case. The court held Alcoa to discharge its duty if it warned its intermediary and had reasonable assurance that intermediary would go ahead and warn the consumer. Mr. Roach suggests that in the Court of Appeals, the mandate of this court prevented the Court of Appeals from considering whatever warnings Alcoa claims they gave to CMS. The real argument that Alcoa is advancing is that the mandate is in error, not that the Court of Appeals error, because this court's mandate did indicate to the Court of Appeals, look to the evidence of warnings to JFW. If Alcoa's position is that the mandate was in error, that should have been brought to this court's attention during the prior hearing on this case. It has been waived by virtue of the fact that the mandate was never assailed before this court. Additionally, there's real good reason why the court's in its mandate only talked about this. Until the Court of Appeals disposed of this case for the second time, nobody had seriously contended that there was evidence that Alcoa warned 7-Up and had some sort of assurance that 7-Up would turn around and warn the consumer. The evidence shows, the evidence the Court of Appeals relies upon, shows a couple of meetings between Alcoa representatives and 7-Up representatives over a period of 3 years. there is no mention of the fact that consumer injury is a serious problem with the Alcoa closure system. There is no mention in any of that area that the rate and frequency of injuries is increasing. And up until the Court of Appeals held that that was sufficient evidence to overcome the jury's finding of gross negligence, no one had been, neither party, had been seriously arguing that it had any substantial significance to this case. And that's really the reason, I think, why this court's mandate was phrased as it was.
As a legal matter, should a remote designer be allowed to inform any intermediary of the danger?
I'm not sure if I understand the question. If the question
is, there's a number of intermediaries between the ultimate consumer and a remote designer, should the remote designer be allowed to advise any or perhaps all of the intermediaries of the danger so as to warn the ultimate consumer?
The issue is always whether the remote designer manufacturer has reasonable assurance. If its conduct directed towards one intermediary is sufficient to convince the jury that it has reasonable assurance, then that is satisfactory. If its conduct with respect to all of a line of intermediaries is not sufficient to convince the jury that it had reasonable assurance that the warning would be passed on, then that is not satisfactory. It's essentially a fact-based inquiry for a jury, and the ultimate question is, does the remote supplier have reasonable assurance that a warning will be delivered to the people who are endangered by the product?
Do you agree or disagree with counsel for Alcoa that standard is unique to Texas and to the Alcoa 1 opinion?
No, Your Honor. As I was saying just a few seconds ago, the standard is first enunciated in the Restatement of Torts First, 1934, Section 388. It is carried through the Second Restatement of Torts. It has been adopted in many cases throughout the United States. We cite about 20 of them with varying kinds of results.
I guess there's varying ways of wording this, too.
Yes. And it's not, plaintiff is not contending that it's a question of magic word or semantics. It is a question of general, ordinary negligence kind of principles being applied to a situation where the remote party has a duty to disclose to the people who are endangered by the remote party's product. And reasonable assurance is as good a terminology as any other. It is also the terminology that was used by the framers of the restatement, and the terminology that this court used in its previous.
That's in Restatement 1, but that very term.
Yeah, reasonable assurance. The issue is whether we've got it in the brief, and perhaps Mr. Matthews can cite it specifically to the court, but the reasonable assurance language, yes, does occur in the first restatement. A second general point that Mr. Roach makes on behalf of Alcoa is that they were somehow prevented from trying this case the way they wanted because of the new rule. And we suggest in the brief a couple of responses to that, but would further suggest to the court that the real simple answer to that is just because the law changes, if in fact it has changed, doesn't mean that they're entitled to a new trial. They have done nothing to preserve any kind of error which they would assert as a reason for a new trial. All they do is they come before the court saying, the law changed, please give us a new trial. We'd like to have the jury instructed differently. We might have some more evidence that we would get into the record if we didn't at this time. And as far as I know, there is just no general legal principle that says just because the law changes, the parties are entitled to a new trial. A good example is this court's opinion in Duncan versus Cessna. Now, everybody agrees that Duncan versus Cessna made a huge change in Texas court law. And there's no disagreement at all with the significance of it. And as I'm sure the court is aware, the defendant in that case, Cessna, made the same argument. It said, give us a new trial. We'd like to take advantage of comparative causation. We didn't get a chance to do that. Justice Spears, speaking for this court, rejected that suggestion, saying that if the court were to remand for a new trial, giving Cessna the benefit of comparative causation,
Cessna would be required to introduce exactly the same type of evidence as it did in the present trial, allowing Cessna to offer the same proof on retrial that it failed to preserve by double exceptions would serve no purpose except to emasculate the general purpose for having double exceptions.
But this court has on occasion given new trials in the interest of justice.
Yes, it has. Yes, it has, Your Honor. But again, in the Cessna case, the court says that the interest of justice remand rule, which used to be 505, it may be recodified now, I'm not sure, does not apply in a situation where the party waives the error that it complains of.
Cessna, we said the result would have been the same if it had been remanded. That's the reason we didn't remand.
But that was 5-4 on that point.
That's as good as 9-0.
I'm not sure of that.
Certainly for a lawyer, it has the same presidential effect as 9-0. I was going to go ahead and speak with the court about our second point of error. That's the point of error dealing with the substantive definition of gross negligence. Since I'm already running into Mr. Matthews for time, I will leave that particular point to the briefing and would only add one thing further to the briefing, and that is that we have suggested that the true definition of gross negligence in Texas was misinterpreted by the Court of Appeals. We are not suggesting that the definition of gross negligence should be changed. We are merely saying that you can tell by looking at cases like Atlas Chemical that in order for a jury finding on gross negligence to be overturned on appeal, the type of care that the appellate court looks at must be care of some significance to meet the problem. And that, I think, we feel is a fair generalization from Atlas Chemical.
My name is Doug Matthews. I represent the respondent and petitioner Jim Ong in this case and have since sometime prior to 1981. This case has been with us a long time. It was tried in August and September of 1981. It's a jury verdict where the jury found Alcoa both ordinarily negligent and grossly negligent. Found ordinary damages of $305,000, found punitive damages of $1 million. Judgment was entered in November of 1981. The case has been on appeal. It will be 8 years in the fall of this year. It's been twice to the Court of Appeals and once to this court.
You've made about as much law as you're interested in making.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the position of Alcoa, let me just briefly comment on a couple of things that were raised by Mr. Roach and raised by the questions. And that is, with respect to Alcoa's position, I think the court has to look at, this case was tried, as I say, 7 years, almost 8 years ago. It had to do with the 1976 accident, June of 1976. It deals with history about this hazard prior to 1976. Alcoa tried this case fervently and strongly with its corporate representative, who testified three times in trial and sat through the entire trial, taking the position that no warning to consumers is necessary. Consumers should not be warned. That was her position over and over and over again. Now they want a new trial and they want to go back, and somehow they want to take a position, I'm not sure how this can possibly be, to have the jury instructed a warning is necessary to consumers, and we want to see consumers warned about this hazard, but we warned 7-Up, and 7-Up should have warned the consumers. That's not a reasonable position. That's not a position that they can take with the evidence in the case. There's no need for a new trial. The case would cover exactly the same evidence, but I believe exactly the same itself.
Isn't that the position they took at the trial court, but he objected to it as irrelevant?
No, Your Honor. The one place where this matter comes up is where they're offering the evidence of 7-Up. I thought the evidence was irrelevant because I thought that there was no indication, I still think there's no indication when you look at those 10 sheets of paper, of any warning to 7-Up. And therefore, on the issues before us, I thought there was not really relevant evidence. The court granted the objection with respect to, as Judge Stovall, he has a way of doing this sort of thing, he granted us to the general issue, I think is what he said, but he allowed the evidence into evidence as to the issue of gross negligence. Alcoa was not harmed because the only way they could have been harmed is if the documents had not reached the jury or if there had been a limiting instruction to the jury, limiting the evidence to, let's say, gross negligence. Neither of those things happened.
How did he let it in without a limiting instruction?
Because none was requested, Your Honor, and none was given.
And the jury did not know it was let in for only one purpose?
There was no instruction to the jury. If I understand the practice, Your Honor, one must request an instruction and the judge must say to the jury, this evidence is being limited for a certain purpose. It is only being allowed in for a certain purpose. That did not happen. In fact, what the judge was really inviting us to do was see if somebody wanted to request a limiting instruction, and neither side did. So if that should have been done, I don't think it should have been done in hindsight. There was waiver in that respect. There's no harm because the evidence was entirely in front of the jury for all purposes. Moreover, Alcoa was in a position to know the law, Your Honor. They knew, certainly with 127 lawsuits, if I recall, all over the country where bottle caps designed by them were blowing off and causing eye injuries, and they'd been sued in a number of jurisdictions. They'd had occasion at some point to pick up the restatement parts and find out about how one goes about defending a case where warnings are the issue in the case. But they chose not to use that theory because that was inconsistent with their basic premise. Their basic theory in the case was that no warning was necessary to consumers. It would not be consistent to be saying, out of one side of the mouth, we shouldn't be warning consumers, and out of the other side, actually a warning is necessary, but we warn 7-Up and 7-Up. With respect to the 7-Up evidence, we suggest that 7-Up evidence is not really evidence of either a warning or a reasonable assurance. It's not an evidence of a warning because it does not contain any indication of the hazard. There is one slideshow that showed one time at one 7-Up meeting. There is one suggestion that there is a blow-off that actually hits the light bulb. It doesn't put out one of the suggestions. There is no indication that it can cause injury. There is no indication of 7-Up of the number of injuries that have been occurring around the country. There's no indication of the number of lawsuits that have been filed. There's no indication of the fact that their own expert has found that it was the most serious problem with respect to this product in 1970. So 7-Up was kept in the dark about this hazard. More significantly, using the reasonable assurance approach, there's no indication by 7-Up to, there's no indication by Alcoa and 7-Up in those documents, and we've attached them in our appendices, that a warning ought to be given to the consumer. Keep in mind now, again, Alcoa's position is the consumer should not be warned So they're not telling someone up in those documents or in those meetings, you ought to give a warning to the consumer. There is not even a hint that there is a necessity of giving a warning to the consumer. So how can Alcoa be reasonably assured that someone up is going to warn the consumer? In fact, we have these meetings that occur from 1972 to 1975. This probably comes out of 1965, lost again in 1967. The meetings between 72 and 75, this actually happens in 76. And for four years, there isn't even a mention of anything about a warning. Now, how can they be reasonably assured that someone is going to warn the consumer? Because they've got a duty to warn the consumer, which is only met by the law. If they give information to the intermediaries, and if they have reasonable assurance that the intermediary is likely going to warn the consumer. There's no indication of that. The Idaho Supreme Court, in the Swyman case, considered exactly the same kind of evidence. The only thing was that accident happened about 2 years later, and there's more accidents, there's more blow-offs. And they found, and the jury in that case found gross negligence and found punitive damages. And the Idaho Supreme Court is looking at the same evidence, and they say, we see no indication that Alcoa is warning 7-Up. It's the same parties. It's Alcoa and 7-Up. It's the same issue. It's the same hazard. And the Idaho Supreme Court says, we don't see any indication of any assurance. In fact, this is, I've just suggested to you, there is no mention of a warning. And the Idaho Supreme Court says, with respect to the other issues of the case, and I'm a little short on time here, we also suggest that the court look at this case from the standpoint of not a new rule of law, but of the rule of law of Atlas Chemical versus Anderson, Justice Stakely enunciated before Burke Rowling was ever handed down. And it said, if you want to look at the care of a defendant in trying to determine whether or not that care is significant care to overcome a finding of gross negligence, that care has got to be significant care to meet the problem. We suggest that is the rule here, and we suggest that the only care, if you will, that the Court of Appeals has found on the part of the defendant is these 10 pieces of paper that we've attached involving about four meetings with 7-Up, one presentation of a slideshow. And if that is sufficient care to meet the problem, then I simply don't understand why. In Atlas Chemical, in Kanabe, in Broussard, in all the cases applying that kind of rule, the defendant has evidences of care. But the question is, are they beginning to do anything about the problem? Obviously, that's not happening here. The number of lawsuits is increasing, the number of injuries is increasing, and therefore, we suggest that when the court looks at this case from the standpoint of significant care to meet the problem, the evidence cited by the Court of Appeals, that is the so-called warnings to 7-Up, is not significant care to meet the problem. Lastly, we suggested that the Court of Appeals did invade our right to trial by jury. With respect to the gross negligence issue, I want to please keep in mind that the Court of Appeals found that the Alcoa was ordinarily negligent, found that the gross negligence findings against Alcoa were legally sufficient, but found that they were not factually sufficient. Within that finding, they arrived at two findings of fact. Affirmative findings of fact. One was that there really was a warning by Alcoa to 7-Up, and the other was that there really was reasonable assurance given to Alcoa that 7-Up would warn the consumers. And we suggest to you that's nowhere in the record, and the Court of Appeals does not have that power. Chief Justice Phillips.
I think your time has expired. I'm giving you every benefit of punctuation on that.
Long time, sir.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the court. Two most important things that I want to address are what Alcoa's position at trial was and what Alcoa's position on this appeal is. The second is to revisit reasonable insurance. What Alcoa's position at trial was not that the ultimate consumer should not be warned. That was not Alcoa's position. We didn't believe that a warning was necessary at that time because we believed then, and we still believe now, that the proper way to deal with the hazard of Capilla is that the bottler not misapply the cap. It is not tough to do. All you have to do is keep your headset in proper adjustment and maintain it properly, and the testimony at trial was you never ever get a bad application. If there was a bad application and you use the visual batch and hold quality control procedure where you look at the caps after they've been applied to the bottle, you could catch a bad cap, you could catch a whole lot of bad caps if your machine has gone out of adjustment, and it never reaches the shelf. Now that's what Alcoa thought then, and that's what Alcoa thinks now. Now we made sure that the intermediaries knew about the hazard. Never occurring. But if the law is, as plaintiff says, that everybody should have known since 1934 there were intermediary responsibilities, then it was the intermediary's responsibility to decide whether or not he had been effective in catching the problem, preventing it from occurring, or in warning the people that he sold to, whether that's 7-Up, who sells to people, or whether that's the retailer, Lewis & Cooper or Safeway. It is not Alcoa's position that a warning is not required under any set of circumstances. If the bottler and the franchisor can't prevent a blow-off potential from occurring, then they should warn. But we don't believe that a warning is required. We don't think that that's the proper way to go about it. The suggestion that Alcoa did nothing in the face of increasing claims is simply wrong. First, because as I just said, we made a concerted effort to tell franchisors and bottlers and anybody else in the industry that the problem could exist if the caps were not properly applied. That's what Alcoa did to deal with the problem. And that's why a gross negligence finding is not appropriate. Even if this court finds there is not reasonable assurance that Alcoa, through its warnings to 7-Up, negated its ordinary negligence responsibility, discharged its duty, that's not the test for gross negligence. That's the test for ordinary negligence. This Section 388 concept does not apply to gross negligence. If Alcoa proves, whatever the definition of reasonable assurance is, that Alcoa had reasonable assurance, then you don't have negligence to start with, because Alcoa would have discharged its responsibility. So obviously you couldn't be found gross negligence. Now, even if Alcoa, so again, even if this court finds that Alcoa did not have reasonable assurance with respect to the 7-Up evidence, the Court of Appeals can still be affirmed as far as that evidence negating conscious indifference, because it shows that Alcoa was trying to do something about the problem. The Court of Appeals was convinced that in light of that evidence, it was unreasonable to believe that Alcoa had not discharged its responsibility. The Court of Appeals found that there was positive feedback demonstrating reasonable assurance in that evidence. And we believe that that was correct. But the point remains that you can't reinstate the gross negligence finding based on reasonable assurance. The negligent concept, and if there was reasonable assurance, then you wouldn't have ordinary negligence to start with. But what is reasonable assurance? I thought I had challenged to demonstrate one case anywhere in this country prior to this court's decision, and a case relying on this court's decision, where reasonable assurance had been construed as they were construing it. I didn't hear any at all. All I heard was a reference to Section 388. There is no case. Jones v. Hill and the other cases cited by this court when it adopted the intermediary rule, in none of those cases did they interpret reasonable assurance as a reasonable belief that the warning will reach the ultimate consumer. If you had to think of what the wording should be, it would be reasonable assurance that the intermediary could pass along the information to the ultimate consumer if it so desired, because that's what all the holdings are. Jones v. Hill and all of the bulk supplier cases in this country. Prescription drug cases, exactly the same. If the patient doesn't receive the warning, the doctor's prescribed the drug anyway, you don't make the prescription drug company liable because it wasn't indicated that the consumer or the patient would receive that warning.
I have not studied this, but it looks to me like it's the reasonable assurance that the intermediate would pass it along is the same size the flip side of reasonable assurance that the ultimate consumer will receive.
Well, Your Honor, this is the perfect case for making that distinction.
Tell me the distinction now. Not what you said, reasonable assurance that they'd get it and understand it and make their own decision, but I think you just said reasonable assurance that the intermediate would pass it along to the consumer.
Two different concepts. Reasonable assurance as to the intermediary versus reasonable assurance as to the ultimate consumer.
But that if it's reasonable assurance that the intermediary is going to pass it along, that's the same thing as reasonable assurance that somebody's going to receive it.
Absolutely. But that, our position is that's not the test.
Okay, well then I wrote down what you said. That was wrong, because yours is reasonable assurance that the intermediary has received it and understood it and
right.
made it his or her own, its own determination.
Yeah, and the most important concept of that is capable of passing along the warning. If, I mean, the language that goes along with reasonable assurance is the mere presence of an intermediary does not discharge the remote supplier's duty to warn. Well, that's right. If that intermediary either doesn't understand the nature of the hazard, and most importantly, if that intermediary isn't capable of passing along the warning, it's a mere intermediary, and its presence should not discharge anybody's liability. But if that intermediary does understand and is capable of passing along the warning, then that ought to be enough. Now, that is the language of comment L of Section 388, which I have here, Your Honor. And comment L refers to comment N. Comment N is the place where reasonable assurance is referred to. And comment L reads, the supplier's duty to exercise reasonable care to inform those for whose use the article is supplied of dangerous but peculiarly within his balance sheet. If he has done so, he is not subject to liability even though the information never reaches those for whose use the chattel is supplied. The next sentence then says the factors that you take into consideration are found in comment N. Now, comment N is where this court will find the reasonable assurance language.
Did you object to this in the motion for rehearing?
We did, Your Honor. Absolutely. Demand, well, we certainly raised reasonable assurance, and we also raised the mandate problem, which was referenced earlier. Suggestion was made that we had failed to preserve our error on the mandate. Not sure that you will find in our motion for rehearing the objection to this court's mandate not including 7-Up. Now, the most important thing, Your Honor, is that the Alm has not responded to the two points that we are here on our petition for. They've only discussed prototype. They do not deny that 7-Up should be an appropriate intermediary. That's not contested. They also do not contest that the jury was not instructed on the rule and that the evidence was precluded. Instead, they claim no harm, no foul. Now, that's just not true. That's not accurate. The Fifth Circuit, as we said, found that failing to instruct the jury required a remand. In this context, I could argue that it probably led to the failure to properly instruct the jury, probably led to the rendition of improper judgment. I mean, the Court of Appeals has already found that evidence to be sufficient to negate its gross negligence finding. And on the opinion on rehearing the first Court of Appeals decision, the court found the plaintiff had failed to prove that Alcoa inadequately warned 7-Up. We believe that if the jury understood that Alcoa could discharge its duty to warn through 7-Up, that that evidence takes on a completely different significance to that jury. And as Justice Sears points out, when the jury is denied that evidence, let me respond. There are brief sites, Yarborough versus Cooper, and that decision does not say that there has to be a limiting instruction. In that case, the question was whether or not there was a limited offer, and that's exactly what this record is. Mr. Connolly made a limited offer because the court had sustained the general offer. That limited offer was a limiting instruction. And Chief Justice Phillips, you're correct when you point out that the jury did hear that evidence, the 7-Up evidence, was not relevant to the negligence issue. Now, Justice Sears is correct when he says, when the jury did not give the benefit of that evidence on the negligence issue, and when the jury is fundamentally misinstructed, we can't have a fair trial. And the suggestion that we waive that is equally meritorious, unmeritorious. We can't waive something that we don't know what's going to happen. Duncan is a procedural matter, by and large. And it was pointed out, that's where the result was not going to be given. We believe that the jury would find that the jury knew that Alcoa could discharge its duty to warn through 7-Up, and it had the benefit of 7-Up's knowledge, what 7-Up knew at that time about the hazard. They would find that Alcoa was communicating to someone who already knew about the problem and was capable of passing along the warning, but had chosen not to. Now, this court clarifying restatement, Section 388 is very important. This reasonable assurance step is something which will visit us for the rest of our lives. So it's very important that this court now clarify what reasonable assurance is and what reasonable assurance is not. Thank you.
Thank you. The court will take another second.
The audience will take their eyes.